Hello, this is Blaine from the future, going through after editing the episode. I just wanted to apologize up front. I had picked up a new microphone stand just before John and I recorded this, and I didn't realize I didn't have it completely tightened, and my microphone was slowly drifting, so instead of being pointed at my mouth, it started pointing to my shoulder and the wall. Unfortunately, that does impact the audio quality on my voice in this episode. I apologize for that, and hopefully this is the last time it happens. Now, on with the podcast. It was the dawn of the third age of podcasting, 30 years after the series had launched.
The Babylon podcast was a dream given form. Its goal, to discuss the place where humans and aliens could work out their differences peacefully.
It's a port of call, home away from home for established fans, newbies, John, Blaine, and guests.
Humans and aliens wrapped in 2,500,000 tons of spinning metal, all alone in the night.
It could be a dangerous place.
Wait, what?
But it's our last, best hope for peace.
This is the story of the last of the Babylon stations.
The year is 2024.
The name of the podcast is
Babylon 5, 30 years later.
Hello and welcome back to Babylon 5, 30 years later. This is a podcast that is looking at every episode and tie-in and spin-off of the Babylon 5 science fiction franchise 30 years after they were released. And my name is John Wilson, and I'm here every week along with my good friend Blaine Dowler. Hello, Blaine.
Hello, John. How are you doing?
Well, you know, I was feeling kind of sick. The doctor said that he could fix me up, and my parents said that they had a problem with that. But, you know, we got through it. We managed to come out okay on this one.
Okay. Well, that's always good.
Yeah, which is not exactly what happens in the show, but we'll talk about that. We're talking about Believers today, y'all, and I want to throw up a content warning just for, you know, anyone out there. This episode deals directly with terminal illness and child death and those sorts of things. So if you know, are going through stuff or have gone through stuff where those sorts of topics might be touchy for you, then come back next week and we will still love you and we will still be here.
Yeah, we can. If you want, jump ahead to getting formed to the dream for the couple notes of what's going to be relevant in the long term. But yeah, there is a bit of a gut punch in this episode.
Yes. So this is an interesting one. This is the 10th episode of season one. It is called Believers, and it was written by one David Gerrold. Fans of Star Trek, long-term fans of Star Trek, maybe not recent fans of Star Trek, but long-term fans of Star Trek, recognize the name David Gerrold. His first claim to fame was as a very young man selling the script for The Trouble with Tribbles to Paramount and getting that produced. He also did a script for the animated series, More Tribbles, More Troubles. And he went on to write for The Next Generation. I can picture that episode. I don't remember the name of it now. He had an idea for a story, and he actually ended up writing a novel that explored the idea more fully. But David Gerrold has done a whole lot of science fiction books over the years. He has a whole series called the Chator Universe series. And J. Michael Straczynski approached him to write this episode because David Gerrold had no children of his own. He and his partner had never had children, and so they adopted a young boy about 7 years old. And it was very shortly after that that JMS said, "Hey, I have this idea for an episode I would like you to write." And David Gerrold's like, "Why do you want me to write it?" And he gets into the story points that JMS presents. And it's about a boy named Sean who is about the same age as the boy that David Gerrold had just adopted. And Gerrold's like, "Oh, I see. I think that's the story. Did I get all those points right?"
For the most part, aside from adding in that when Gerrold realized why Straczynski asked him to write this one, because he could identify with it so clearly, he made those connections at 2 a.m. And at 2 a.m., he went, looked in on his boy for a little while, and then picked up the phone and called Straczynski and called him some nasty names before saying, "Now I understand why you asked me to write this."
And he called thinking he'd be waking Straczynski up, but Straczynski likes to keep writing until 3 or 4 a.m. because, generally speaking, then the phone doesn't ring and he can stay focused.
So this episode aired on April 27th, 1994. So, of course, we are discussing it on April 27th, 2024. The director is our familiar Richard Compton. J. Michael Straczynski also has a writing credit.
Yeah, his IMDb lists him as with a writing credit on every episode, just a series creator.
Okay.
But David Gerald is the only name officially on the script.
I see.
Even though Gerald's script doesn't have the Raiders subplot that would have been added by either Straczynski or DiTillio.
Gotcha. So Trisha O'Neill is in this. She plays the mother of the family we're going to be talking about. I do not recognize her. I'm looking through her list of credits, and the vast majority of her credits predate, you know, they're from the 90s and earlier. And it's just a lot of one-off credits here and there, and I don't think I recognize her. Do you know her from anything?
Yeah, she was actually Captain Rachel Garrett might be what she's best known for.
Oh!
So in the Next Generation episode, Yesterday's Enterprise, yeah, she is the captain of the Enterprise C. And yeah, she had command presence on her deathbed.
That's a fantastic credit. I guess I scrolled right past that. But yeah, Captain Rachel Garrett is very memorable. And you can see that same force of presence in the mother in this, even though I think for cultural reasons, mm-hmm. she defers a little. Well, we'll talk more about her, but she defers a bit to her husband in this. But I think that she's still pretty strong here. The first credit in her IMDb list has a very interesting name, very much of its time, that I won't repeat here. Then for the father, we have Stephen Lee, and he is known for War Games and The Negotiator and Burlesque and La Bamba, but I've seen War Games once many, many moons ago, but he's another person that I feel like I should know him, but I don't.
Yeah, before we go too far from Trisha O'Neill, just scrolling through it, I do want to point out she also appeared in 5 episodes of Murder, She Wrote. And her 5th appearance on Murder, She Wrote was in one of the episodes written by J. Michael Straczynski.
Okay.
Season 8, episode 5.
So I don't know how much time writers spend on set once they turn in their script. I know that, you know, it gets onto the director or anything after that, but it's possible that they had a chance to meet or he saw her in action at that point and may have kept her in mind.
Yeah, I don't know if he saw her on set, because in most shows it is unusual for the writer to be on set. Babylon 5 was a bit of an exception.
Mm-hmm.
In which the writers were encouraged to be on set to sort of protect their words. That is one of the things that people mentioned when they come into Babylon 5. You know, they are used to having things heavily rewritten and not being part of the final process.
Right.
So I guess in TV, you're lucky if half of your script is what's filmed, if you're not the showrunner. And in Babylon 5, it was more like 75% or more. So having read a copy of David Gerald's script, aside from the insertion of the Raiders subplot, it's virtually untouched, which is also a bit rare because Straczynski found when other writers used Kosh, he would often have to go through and trim down his lines because Kosh is very direct and to the point. And this is one of the few cases where Kosh's dialogue is left intact because Gerald got it the first time.
And the last guest star is a very young Jonathan C. Kaplan, who is credited as Jonathan Charles Kaplan, and he had a handful of appearances in Boy Meets World, or he had a recurring role in Brotherly Love for just a few episodes. Other than that, it looks like just a bunch of one-off TV parts that, again. So, 3 characters, 3 guests. The fact that their careers may not be memorable for us individually doesn't reflect upon their performances here because I think they did a great job. So we should get into the story.
We should probably just point out as well, I think Silvana Gallardo as Dr. Maya Hernandez.
Oh, poop on a stick, you're right.
So she was in here as well. Again,
it's probably Gallard though.
Okay. I will defer to your expertise in pronunciation of Spanish names since you're the Spanish teacher and I'm in Canada where Spanish is almost non-existent. Looks like her most prominent role was a recurring role on Days of Our Lives. And this was one of her last roles. Unfortunately, she passed away at age 58 in 2012. So again, Babylon 5 is plagued with that. In fact, of the five major, we really see five members of the Babylon 5 crew here. There's Sinclair, Garibaldi, Dr. Franklin, Hernandez, and Ivanova. And Claudia Christian, who played Ivanova, is the only one of those five that's still with us.
Okay. Yeah, I was thinking about how this is pretty much a very focused show on Dr. Franklin, Sinclair, and Ivanova play secondarily important roles. And then Garibaldi kind of has a bit of a walk-in part.
Yeah, Ivanova heads up the B-plot for maybe 5 minutes of screen time.
Right. So speaking of the B-plot, the A-plot is... We open with a very charming scene of a boy on a hospital bed with Dr. Franklin assuring him that he is going to be just fine. The doctor is going to fix him up. This is exactly what you'd expect to see before an operation, where there is very little chance of anything going wrong. And it's going to be just fine. We're just, you know, shoring up the boy's confidence in his own recovery. Until the parents find out that this is actually going to involve a surgical operation. And it turns out that their beliefs, their worldview, their understanding of how, you know, the world works, their planetary people are the chosen of God. And they, as a part of their belief system, don't believe in puncturing or cutting a person. That is something that you only do to food animals. And this is a very crucial concept for them. So even though the boy is going to die without surgical assistance, he has some growths and some blockages in his lungs and breathing organs, and they can be cleared out. The doctor can go in there and just remove them. It's not uncommon for it to develop with people of their physiological intricacies. And he can clear it up, but they do not want it to happen. So the course of the episode is largely wrestling with this topic. The doctor wants to go over the heads of the parent. He feels that as part of his Hippocratic oath, he is obligated to save the child. He tries to, they don't put it in this phrase, in the terms of passing the buck, and maybe he's not even consciously feeling it that way, but he tries to pass the buck to Commander Sinclair by asking Commander to rule on whether or not he should operate on the child. And after deliberating extensively and interviewing the parents and interviewing even the son, which is an interesting conversation because the son is upholding his people's beliefs. And that kind of raises the question, maybe in Sinclair's mind of, yeah, but he's a child. Should his commitment to this belief be, you know, held the same as an adult's? I don't know. But in any case, he eventually rules in favor of the family and the parents. He doesn't want to set a precedent for Babylon 5 interfering in the intrapersonal cultural beliefs and affairs of a civilization. So Franklin is told to basically let the boy die. And throughout all of this, of course, the parents are racked with all the various complex emotions you would expect to be involved in this. They're, of course, grieving the anticipated loss of their child, but they're trying to reassure themselves and reassure their child that he will be in the nest of the egg. And Franklin decides, you know what? To hell with it. I'm doing it anyway. So whenever the parents aren't looking, he goes in and does the operation. The boy wakes up, and it's really hard to tell how he's feeling because he is very stone-faced. Almost looks accusatory. He almost looks very upset that Dr. Franklin operated on him. But as soon as his parents walk into the room, he sits up, and for the first time, we see this child's full personality come through, and he jumps out of bed to run to his parents, full of joy, and they basically cast him out. They treat him like an inhuman creature of evil, because what's been done to him. And the idea is that by puncturing a person, you allow their soul to escape. So they're no longer an actual person. So Franklin is feeling, you know what? It was weird. It was a hard decision, but I did the right thing. throughout all of this, he's had a new character assistant who we mentioned earlier, Dr. Maya Hernandez. And she basically serves the purpose of dialogue partner with Franklin to sort of explore the ideas with him. She pretty consistently throughout the episode stands on the side of this is the medically right decision. The boy deserves to live. His parents shouldn't condemn him to death for beliefs. And so she's sort of that opinion as a sounding board. And so Franklin's talking to her and she does some research on the beliefs of the culture and she pulls something up and shows Franklin and he immediately bolts down the hallway to the family's quarters where he finds the family in a ritual assisted suicide situation. They have essentially, they don't say this flat out in the script, but to all appearances, they have killed their child rather than let him continue to live in his current state. So, yes, that's the A plot. That's basically how things wrap up. The B plot, like Blaine said, is a very brief plot. The station gets a distress call early in the episode from the Starliner Asimov, a ship we have seen and heard mentioned earlier in the series. And they are in what they call raider territory. I don't think we get anything more than that, just raiders, not a species or anything else. So Ivanova, so Sinclair's like, okay, well, is Garibaldi available? Let's send him out there to help them out. And she's like, oh, okay, yeah. I only have 100 hours of flight experience. I'll just stand here and, you know, knit something. And he's like, okay, why don't you take a wing and head out there? So she does. She leads a squad and they encounter one ship. She breaks off and goes after the ship to pursue it when it tries to get away. She ends up confronting a whole bunch of the ships. And I didn't get a chance to rewatch this episode, Blaine. Do we see how she resolves that, or does she just show up back at the station all fine?
Yeah, we get the one time we see her, a whole bunch of raiders are appearing on her screen. And then the next time we see her, she is back at the station.
Okay.
And she's, you know, sort of rotating her arm as she's, so it's like her shoulder has been injured as she's putting her jacket on. And Garibaldi is saying, your Star Fury is going to be in the shop for at least a week. Something happened out there. Let's talk.
Yeah, so she looks like she's acting like she's been in a fight, but we didn't see any of it. And so she comes back and that's basically taken care of. So, you know, 90-95% of this is the story with the family. The bit with Ivanova is a pretty small element, but it does give her a chance to actually be a person and shine a bit. And we haven't seen her fly before. In fact, I don't even know if we got any indication that she was a pilot. So now we have that for her. So yeah, this is a bit of a quagmire of an episode to talk about. What are you thinking, Blaine?
Yeah, this is one where you see the distinction where JMS said Babylon 5 is not a moral show, it's an ethical show.
Mm-hmm.
So he wants to start discussions and arguments, but he's not so much about coming down and saying, this is right and this is wrong, and you see Timmy, and preaching a little bit. So a lot of viewers watching this are going to feel very strongly. The Babylon 5 fan groups on social media were actually talking about this episode last week, and a lot of fans don't like it because they don't like the way it makes them feel, and they keep trying to say, well, why didn't the doctors do this solution or this solution or this solution? They're basically saying, well, why wasn't there an easy surgical solution so we didn't have, or non-surgical solution so we didn't have to feel everything we felt?
Mm.
And when JMS is responding to that in the old Usenet post, he's like, well, that's the whole point, is that there is no easy solution. So you have to wrestle with the ethics of this. That's like the entire point of the episode, is to not have an easy out, which does set it aside from some other shows set in space.
Right.
Where I think other shows, they would have found, they would have found a non-surgical solution to keep the family happy, where the family would have been happy when they saw their son was unchanged.
Right. They would have wrestled with the question and then found an all happy ending many times.
Yeah.
I was kind of struck because this episode opens with such a happy conversation and Dr. Franklin is like, You're going to be fine. You're going to grow up big and strong and bring honor to your family. And I am never wrong about these things. And I fully believe that he is confident in his ability and he knows if he can succeed or not. So whenever he declares this is going to succeed, he has had no reason to doubt that those kinds of assertions, that kind of confidence. But then the end of this episode just goes completely against his confidence at the beginning of the episode.
Yeah, it's definitely a gut punch and a tonal shift here. You do get the feeling that, yeah, it's going to be solved somehow. You know, and any other show, he would have convinced them, or, you know, if transporter technology was there, they could have cleared the blockage that way, done something like that, but or come up with a miracle drug to just have his body break it up. But that's not the way this plays out.
Yeah, anything that we think of that could be a solution, they don't do that. They wrestle with the problem at hand.
Yeah, but one thing that I do find was made clear, like I said, on social media, people saying, well, why didn't they do this? Why didn't they do that? Rewatching after those conversations, there is dialogue in here that clearly says multiple times, this surgery is the only option. This mass is large and it is rooted. They have to take it out physically.
Mm-hmm.
There's no alternative here.
They do really emphasize that.
So that part is absolutely unambiguous. And you know, we see some interesting things because, you know, the family goes to the ambassadors because their species doesn't have an ambassador on the station. So we have short scenes where they're going to, yeah, Shakar and Londo and Delenn and Kosh to have them act as their advocates. And nobody wants to participate.
And they all give various different reasons, but the reasons feel believable from each of them. But it's like, you can see the hope in the parents' faces, and it's just not, doesn't come through.
Yeah, because this is, it was inspired by things that were making the news with things, I think it's Christian Scientists, or essentially the same belief as Jim Henson, where people refuse treatment for spiritual reasons and their understanding of the next life more than this life.
Mm-hmm.
Which, for the drama, it works. As I'm thinking about it, I wonder what happens in this species or this society if you get cut by accident. Right? They say you cannot puncture them with the surgery, but how does that go?
That does, yeah.
Does this have a large suicide rate if people end up getting in industrial accidents or
scraping their knee?
Yeah.
Wow, I hadn't even thought about that.
Yeah, that's really the one sticking point I have is how does the society function if you cannot be punctured? Is it a deliberate puncturing or is it, you know, just certain areas of the body that cannot be punctured so you can't cut into the chest, but the arm is okay? There's, I don't know. There's some questions on that end, but for the purposes of this episode, the belief works well. And it's similar enough to beliefs that people actually have where they refuse treatment to make the story function.
There's some interesting dynamics with the parents. So the father, at the beginning of the episode, he is presented as almost, or at least putting up a facade of being emotionally detached from his son's impending death. And he tells us flat out that it is for his people a dishonor, a sign of weakness to show feelings in front of strangers. So as the episode goes on, we see him go through a gamut of emotions, but it's in the context of the fact that this is very difficult for him to do.
It is, and we can see part of the functioning of the society where it starts with the mother doing most of the conversation with Franklin until she explicitly gets permission for her husband to speak frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And then her husband speaks to her, and then at the end when they're upset because Franklin objected to their wishes, the father no longer directly speaks to Franklin and the mother is translating again.
Right, I noticed that too. He backed up.
That is part of the roles. It's a little thing, but it does make it feel like, no, this is a more fully realized society and alien culture to have that piece there.
And like I said, she does spend a lot of time deferring to her husband, but also as the speaker of the family, she is assertive and presents their position and does not back down. So you never get the feeling through any of the conversations that any member of the family is reluctant about backing this belief. Like, it's not like, oh, but, you know, if only we could, or if only we didn't have this, I wonder if there's some way to... No, they are committed believers of their, you know, of their cultural worldview. Even Sean is.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that Sinclair asked Sean.
Yeah, I like that moment, and especially Sean's answer where he says, well, yeah, I want to live, but I don't want the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was probably a big part of Sinclair's decision.
They do come out and directly discuss the question of, you know, does God exist? Is he involved in this dilemma? What might he want, and how do we all see God differently? But that part of the conversation is not the crux of the episode. Franklin is a theist on some level. He does believe in some kind of God. Mm-hmm. We know, I believe we've talked about on the show before, how Sinclair is a believer in some form of you know, earth religion. But it's much more, like you said earlier, it's much more focused on the ethics of dealing with the question of whether or not to have the surgery in the context of the conflict, not on the who's right, science or religion. Although I think Hernandez would really like to take the question that direction.
Yeah. Yeah, I think she would. And that's part of it. As a viewer, that is one of the things that I like about it. Because thinking about this, I was asking myself, what would I do if I were in their shoes? And even though there's a lot of conflict, and especially between Sinclair and Franklin because of this, to the point that, you know, when Franklin has done the surgery and he thinks he's done well, and he gets really cocky and he turns to Sinclair checking for an apology, Sinclair says, well, you better check the temperature in hell first before he storms out.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking about what I would do in their situations, I think if I were in Franklin's shoes, I would have done the surgery like he did. But I think if I were in Sinclair's shoes and had to worry about the politics of the station, I would have also denied the request.
Like, no one in this is fully right or fully wrong.
Yeah, that's one of the things I like about it. There is that richness to it.
And, you know, we as people outside the story could come down on the whole empiricist perspective. And like, you know, this is what we know. The child is dying. We can save him. You know, we know that the soul does not escape the body. But like, that's not the point of the story.
No, this, honestly, the thing that this resonated with me that reminded me of the most is an Alfred Hitchcock film called I Confess. It's not one of his best known movies, but it's about what happens when a priest in the confessional has heard a criminal confess his sins. And that criminal's basically saying, yes, I am a killer. These are the people I killed. And then he's watching as the police have arrested the wrong person. And they're putting him up on trial with the death penalty.
Wow.
So it's a similar moral dilemma where there's, you know, one set of rules in this aspect of your life, but a conflicting set of rules in another aspect of your life. And what do you do?
And, you know, I am not a doctor. I do not spend every day of my life fighting for the health and well-being and lives of patients. So I don't have the emotional investment to the core of my being in seeing this child live that Franklin has. So I can see myself, okay, every member involved in this situation wants it to go this way and agreeing with them, even though it goes against my better judgment to do so. But where I do have experience is working with kids' well-being and their social devotional development as young teens as a teacher. And whenever those kinds of questions arise, I do get involved. There are some laws passed in Florida this weekend that affect how we interact with our students in ways that I think invalidate the students who don't fall under the center of the bell curve as far as their, you know, identity goes. And I have had to wrestle with how I'm going to deal with that and behave in such a way that fits with the law, but also fits with my approach to making sure every child feels validated and able to be themselves in my class. And it's not easy.
Yeah, we've had similar legislation here. So where I'm in Alberta, the current government has decided that if parents wish to ask if their child is part of a gay and lesbian alliance, teachers are obligated to tell them. And whether they seem to be there as an ally or in another role, which is something I I hope I'm not put in a position where this is happening. But anyway, yeah. So I think I know what you're saying.
I'm not sure how much else I have to say. This might be one of our shorter episodes, or it might not, depending on other discussions, but I did like Ivanova. I was kind of surprised, actually, with her. She has always been very assertive and no-nonsense and does her job and commanding presence with other characters. But when it comes to her CO, she is yes, commander, and does her job. This was the first time she basically ever talked back to Sinclair that I can recall. And it's not just a brief release of tension. It's like a rant. I'll just walk to and fro. And then maybe for change, I'll just walk fro and to. I'll just knit something, you know, some socks or a sweater. And it's just like, wow. Okay. Tell us how you really feel, Ivanova.
Yeah. Like we said earlier, Claudia Christian does subtle. Ivanova does not do subtle.
Yeah. It was pretty great. And evidently, this is not the first time because Sinclair is just like, okay. Do you, you get it out, and then I'll talk to you. So I don't know. We don't know a whole lot about their history together, but I could see him being like, okay, Susan's doing another thing. She's having a day.
Yeah.
But it is good that, I mean, we get the idea that it is better to her well-being that she be allowed to do something different and use her other skill sets. And Sinclair has absolutely no problems doing that. It just was not his first thought. And maybe he went home that day thinking, I need to make sure to give her more opportunities to get off the station.
Yeah, I think he was thinking that, you know, the XO always has things to do, but the chief of security right now seems to be quiet for him.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, it was a good Ivanova moment. Like I said, she's got 5 minutes of screen time here, maybe, but they're all good minutes.
Yeah. Oh, and in the Star Furies, we saw, for the first time that I can recall, because we've always seen them in their cockpits, like, torso up, like you would normally see in a cockpit shot, they're standing in those things. They're standing in the window, open to, you know, not open to space, air-wise, but open to space because it's a big screen. And they're standing as they fly those things around. They're not sitting, and I just hadn't realized that before.
Yeah, they're kind of sitting, but it is a little bit of a slope. So it's almost more like they're leaning.
Okay.
Which, if you think about the G-forces that you need to make space travel practical with any sort of distance, that makes sense. So they are supported as they're going through. So yeah, if they get rocked, they're not going to fall over because they're standing up. They're still supported by the Star Fury, but yeah, it's a very gentle thing. So when you look at them, it's really only their thighs that are at an angle.
Okay.
So from the knees down, that's parallel to the spine. But yeah, it is a nice touch. So shall we move on to the last best hope here for...
Yeah, if you don't have anything else for our discussion. So last best hope is where we talk about the either character or plot moment or just basically anything from this episode that you're walking away with going, wow, that was pretty great. So what are you thinking for this, Blaine?
I'm actually going to pick, especially knowing that this was the fifth episode in production, even though it was the 10th aired, it was very early. I am most impressed with the fact that they were allowed to end Sean's story the way they did. Mm-hmm. Because that is not an ending that they would be allowed to use in a lot of shows. So credit for B5 for asking for this ending, and credit to the Warner Brothers liaison for allowing them to do it. Because a lot of networks wouldn't. And that's part of what's going to set Babylon 5 apart, is they've got some tough decisions and tough calls coming, and they're not going to shy away from it. And this is one of the earliest examples of that.
Yeah, I didn't mention this moment earlier, but as I was thinking back on the plot beats of the episode, I thought about, so one of the things that Franklin does as a good doctor working with a child, a young child with a good bedside manner, he gives, and knowing that, actually, before we even find out in the script that the egg is their, like, you know, their vision of deity, he gives Sean a small, they keep using the phrase blob of industrial goo, but it's basically, it looks like an egg-shaped piece of rubber, and it has a little bit of an iridescence to it, and he's like, this is a globin egg. and it needs to be held and needs to be stroked so that it can hatch eventually. And I would like you to take care of it while you're, you know, in bed here, just to kind of give Sean, you know, something to put his feelings into. It's a good move. Whenever Sean is talking to Sinclair, he has it in his hand, and Sinclair is like, "What is that?" He says, "It's a gloppet egg." And Sinclair, "What's a gloppet egg?" He's like, "Well, okay, actually, it's just a blob of industrial goo, but don't tell Dr. Franklin. He still thinks it's an egg." So the child has seen through the technique, but also doesn't realize that it was actually just a technique. He thinks that Sinclair actually thinks this is an egg. And I found that so utterly charming. Like, that moment right there made me want to get to know Sean better. Like, I think he's probably a very charming child. And it's, if the whole quandary of the parents and the fact that their child is dying isn't enough to make you reach out to him, that moment of character and just personality from Sean was pretty great. So that's my last best hope.
Okay. Yeah, it was a good moment.
So that takes us to our next segment, our last big segment of the show called Giving Form to the Dream. This is where we don't spoil future events, but we do put, you know, pins and red flags in any elements of this episode that we should just keep in our minds, that we should not forget. We should let, you know, this will come up again later. So I did not get it from the episode, but I'm kind of wondering from things that we said either on mic or off mic, those Raiders, they coming back again?
Yeah, I have four elements of this episode that are going to come back.
Okay.
And the Raiders are the most obvious. Not just the fact that the Raiders exist, but when Ivanova is swarmed by the Raiders and we see them appearing on her screen, we don't see small Raiders getting bigger as they're approaching her from a distance. We see about a dozen Raiders just appear.
Right.
That part is going to be important.
We see it on a tactical screen, so we don't see any like special visual effects like a Romulan decloaking or anything. But yeah, I did notice they just appeared out of nowhere right after she blew up their ship. So, but also I think the fact that you mentioned that they were not in David Gerald's original scripts, they were a deliberate addition by Straczynski, seemed to tell me that maybe that's a thing that we should pay attention to.
Yeah, in fact, we talked about how the series will rename an episode that fits the theme of the entire season. There's an episode coming up called Signs and Portents. The original title was Raiding Party.
Oh, okay. Which, you know, if we had an episode list, we would know that title was there. All right.
Yeah. Okay, so another element that is going to return, there's actually a couple that seem like throwaway lines. One of them is Sinclair, when he's talking to Franklin about this, saying, you know, well, how do we know which religion is right? Maybe they're all right. Maybe God doesn't care how you say your prayers as long as you say them.
Which is a common approach for a lot of humans.
Yeah, well, that attitude and that perspective is going to come back in a big way at some point.
Okay.
We also have Delenn's dialogue. The reason Delenn has refused to help them, and they thought, well, you're, you know, the Minbar, you're spiritual, they'll help with that. And she says, yes, they've had people interfering in their souls before. And that's why they are forbidden from interfering in this sort of thing in the future. So we've seen that with Soul Hunter.
Mm.
But one of the ways that Straczynski does really well with foreshadowing in this series is that some things mean more than one thing. So there's the obvious meaning, and then there's another meaning.
Sometimes do you think a story begins as an idea of a seed for future events, and then he like builds a whole story around that seed?
Yeah, so at this point when you're watching, you're going, oh, she's probably referring to Soul Hunter, but maybe not. She might be actually referring to something else.
Okay.
And then the fourth one is in the final conversation between Sinclair and Franklin, where Sinclair says, you never should have asked me for a ruling, then you wouldn't have had to disobey orders. And Franklin says, well, I'll keep that in mind for next time.
Yeah, it's worth pointing out that things get really, really tense, beyond tense. Things get hostile between Sinclair and Franklin in this. It starts out, they're on the same side they're on the same team wrestling at this, you know, from different perspectives, but trying to work together. But at the end of the episode, they have some pretty harsh words. And I don't think we see them reconcile in this, do we?
It's not really reconciled. It's a tough situation, and I mean, Franklin was ready to resign over this. He knew that because he was disobeying a direct order. And I will give Sinclair credit for saying, yeah, he's not going to ask for his resignation this time. He's looking at Franklin going, yeah, the way that this all played out, there's nothing he can do that's going to hurt Franklin more than that. So he's like, no, you're feeling the punishment anyway. So let's just move on. So he's not forgiven, but Sinclair has basically said, I can't punish you beyond what's happening to you right now anyway, so let's just go. You know, those are the pieces that are good to keep in mind for the future.
All right. Okay, well, I think that does wrap up our discussion of the episode. We'll talk about how to get in touch with us, but we will, of course, be back next week for Survivors. Wow, that's a hard title after this episode.
Yes, we've got Believers, Survivors, and then... So Believers here is actually the second in a string of six episodes week to week. So we'll have six consecutive weeks of podcasts here.
Mm-hmm.
We are currently in week two, and then we take another pause. We'll do a feedback episode, and then come back for most of the rest of the season.
Yeah, like we said earlier, this season, instead of being like a fall and a spring, it's more like divided into thirds. So we're in the middle of the second third. And if you have thoughts on this episode that you would like to share, we would love to hear them and read them on the air and respond to them. So how can they get in touch with us, Blaine?
One way is to send an email to Babylon5 30yearslater@gmail.com.
You can also go to my website that has all my various podcasts, including this one, and leave comments on the show postings there. That's johnreadscomics.com, and there is no H in comics.
Yes, nor are there H's in Reeds or in John.
I mean, why would there be, obviously?
You can also leave comments at bureau42.com. So that's where all of my podcasts are hosted.
You can leave reviews on your favorite podcatcher. We do check Apple Podcasts. So if you leave us a review on another podcatcher that you would like us to thank you for on the air, just drop us a line through one of these other means to let us know that it's there.
And you can also leave comments on YouTube posts, because we are cross-posting these to YouTube.
All right, so next week it is Survivors. Thank you very much for listening.
And good evening to you.